Welcome to the Real Estate Syndication Show. Whether you are a seasoned investor or building a new real estate business, this is the show for you. Whitney Sewell talks to top experts in the business. Our goal is to help you master real estate syndication. And now your host, Whitney Sewell.
This is your daily real estate syndication show. I'm your host, Whitney Sewell. Today, our guest is Ken Holman. Thanks for being on the show, Ken.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
I'm honored to have you on the show. Your experience, your background, I'm honored to have you on and look forward to hearing about your experience as learning, and the listeners, I know, are going to learn a lot. Ken is the president and CEO of Overland Group, a privately held, vertically integrated real estate fund manager, investor, and operator that builds, owns, and finances properties across the United States. Since founding over 30 years ago, Overland Group has developed over 20 million square feet of commercial space and actively manages over 10.6 million square feet of office, industrial, retail, multifamily, hotel, and healthcare space. He holds the following designations: CCIM, CPM, CRS, and CCA. Has also served as the president of the Utah Apartment Association. Well, I think you're about the most qualified guest I've ever had, Ken.
Oh, my word. Well,
one of them anyway.
You can see all, by all the wrinkles, that I've been around this business a few years.
Well, I'm honored to have you on, and it's great to know somebody like yourself that's had this much experience. But give the listeners a little more about, you know, who you are and maybe a little bit about your background. But, you know, let's dive right into today's topic as well.
Sure. Love to do that. Well, my background, I think, is maybe a little different than most real estate syndicators out there. I got all the standard degrees everybody else did, a degree in accounting and an MBA. I went to law school. So I feel like I'm pretty qualified in that regard. But I think the thing that really prepared me for the real estate business was, while I was growing up in high school and college, I had an opportunity to work with my dad and a couple of my uncles doing real estate construction. So I've done about everything you can imagine in the construction side of the business, from setting up forms and pouring concrete to doing drywall and finish work and all sorts of different things like that. So that's probably the best side of the business that really gave me an appreciation for real estate. And I think I was destined to be in this business from probably the beginning of my career. So a little bit about our business. Our company is, I think you mentioned, Overland Group. We do all different aspects of real estate, brokerage, development, construction, management, and syndication, and basically try to tie all those things together into the projects that we develop. But I think a couple of the projects that we're working on right now are kind of interesting. We're doing two apartment developments, one in St. George, Utah, which, by the way, is one of the hottest markets in the United States, and another project in Mesa, Arizona. Then we're also doing a self-storage project in Arizona as well. And just opened up a couple of days ago, a 536-unit self-storage project in Woods Cross, Utah. So kind of excited about that. Hope that goes well for us. And we're just starting to rent units there.
Wow. You have such a range of things that you all are able to do. It's so impressive. Just reading your bio, you know, you're managing over, 10 million square feet. And, we went through office, industrial, retail, multifamily, hotel, and healthcare. You know, so you're doing all these different things. I would imagine you didn't start that way.
No, we didn't. And I might add that we don't manage 10 million square feet today, but we have over the years that we've been in business. So we manage fewer than that, but we still are involved in all those product types and manage most of the things we're talking about. So
what's been key in being able to grow your ability to be really good at so many different asset classes?
I guess probably the main thing is just, I have been a student of the industry from day one when I got into it. I started working for a real estate syndication company and they did financial planning as well. And then I moved from there into my own company in late 70s, early 80s. And so we've just been going from there. But it seems like it's been a real progression. You don't start out doing everything. I started out in the management side of the business and then was asked to manage several different projects in five different states. And then I went from there to starting my own brokerage firm and then doing And then we thought, okay, we'll do development. So we started that. And then we started construction company. And that was the one thing that almost took me down, is the construction side of the business. And that's been the most difficult to learn how to do and do it effectively. And we originally started with a full-fledged construction company where we were not only doing general contracting, but we ran some of the sub-trades, and we had close to 100 employees that we were dealing with. And I found that that was, for me, a nightmare. I just wasn't excited about, one day we had have too much work to do, and I was out hustling trying to find new employees, and the next day we'd finished a project and we're waiting to get another one going, and so now I've got to lay people off, and that wasn't very fun. So we streamlined our model, and that's the thing that really started helping us get going the way we wanted to go. We got rid of all the sub trades, didn't try to self-perform anything, competitively bid all those things out. And so from a construction standpoint, we just do the project management, project engineering, the estimating, and superintending. And so once we get to that superintendent level, everything below that, we don't self-perform. We competitively bid out. And that enables us to move into all sorts of different markets we otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So we've done projects in Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Wyoming, South Dakota, Montana, just all over the Intermountain Midwest. So
you all are focused now mainly on new development, correct?
We are. We really like that space a lot. Not that you can't do what we do by acquiring existing projects, but I've found I really like to build new as opposed to buy somebody else's problems. And by building new, you can overcome a couple things. Like, you know, if you're acquiring existing properties, you run across economic obsolescence and functional obsolescence that you have to deal with. Economic obsolescence meaning, you know, you're in a market that either is moving up or moving down or moving sideways. And new construction, you're building primarily in markets that are moving up, that are growing and developing. So there's a lot of upside to that. Functional obsolescence, you run across situations where, you know, like an apartment complex has an 8-foot high ceiling and today everything's 9 feet. And so it's hard to overcome those things, or some of the energy savings that exist today didn't exist back then. And so new development is a good path for us. And the other thing I like about new development is you're building at cost. So once you get that project rented up, you wind up having a really significant value add situation that can add 10 to 20% of the value of the project to its overall value. Once you go through that process of development, construction, and rent up and stabilization, people are willing to pay more money for a stabilized project than one that is not stabilized. And so you build it at one price and value it at another. So I think that's really good for investors to be able to have that increase in value that exists. You do have to go through the risk of going through that whole process, but after you've been through it as many times and as many years as we have, we feel like we've got a handle on how to manage the risk. So we feel pretty good about that.
Yeah, 30 years of experience. And I wanted to ask you, though, on an earlier subject, you mentioned, you know, what prepared you was the time spent with your father and uncles, you know, a building and construction and doing all those things in real estate. But, you know, if you had to do it over, would you still get the law degree and the other things as well?
Oh, you have to. Yeah, I don't think you can do this business without having the proper education and background and being able to understand all the legal ramifications associated with this business. This is a technical business. Not very many places you can go to get an education for that. In fact, after I got my accounting degree and an MBA, which I felt qualified me pretty well, I finally said, okay, there's so much on the legal side of this business that I don't know. I really want to learn that. And there isn't anywhere that teaches that. So I applied to law school and said, while I was running my company, I decided, okay, I'm going to go to law school and I'm going to get just those classes that relate to real estate, because they don't let you just kind of take those classes without being enrolled as a student. And so I went in and took all the real estate classes I could find on real property law and contracts and mortgages and tax and all that. And then once I got all that stuff, I said, okay, I don't want to be an attorney. I've got what I need. And so that helped prepare me a lot for this business.
Well, that's impressive that you're able to do that while you were still running your real estate business as well.
Yeah, I think most of the employees that were working for me thought I was nuts, but I thought, you know, it was just something that I thought we needed to do to make this a successful company the way we wanted to. So
it's awesome. So, you know, I know before we started recording, you and I were discussing about how you're incorporating 1031 and self-directed IRAs and regular investors in the same projects. And we thought that, you know, that'd be a great topic, great item for us to dive into a little bit and how you're able to do that. And so I'd love for you to talk about that and us dive in.
I think most syndicators these days are, they go out and they find a group of investors that, you know, have some equity capital that they want to invest in a project. And that's the approach that they take. And we get a lot of those kind of investors. At this stage of my career, I like to work with bigger investors, obviously, as opposed to smaller investors. But I have found that it's possible to incorporate 1031 tax-deferred exchange investors with self-directed retirement account investors and regular investors. And that's not an easy process to do. So I thought it might be fun for your listeners to just hear an explanation of how we go about that process. And maybe there are others that want to incorporate that into their business model. But so today, most real estate projects are done through the formation of a limited liability company, which is the crux of the legal organization that you set up to run the project. And most of these are single asset entities. So we form an LLC. And as most people know, an LLC is a security. And so you get into all of the real estate, you get into all of the SEC requirements relative to registration or non-registration or being exempt from registration. And so we all deal with Reg D, and one of the rules, either 506B or 506C. And 506C is the one that seems to most people gravitate to because it doesn't restrict your ability to advertise, but you just have to deal with accredited investors. Well, you can not only include in that LLC regular real estate investors, but most people don't realize that you can take an IRA or a 401k, and if you have turned it into a self-directed IRA or 401k, and there are several companies out there that can assist investors to do that, but you can then take that IRA or a 401k or any other type of basic retirement account, and they can invest directly in real estate. Most stockbrokers don't tell you about this. Most financial planners don't tell you about this because they don't want to deal with you taking some of your assets or some of your capital and moving it in and investing it directly in real estate. So we work with a lot of clients in accommodating that. I had one client out of Tucson, Arizona, been with me a long time now. He called me one day and said, Ken, I heard you're building a Family Dollar store in Colorado. And he says, I'm sick of being in the stock market. I've got $2 million in my 401k, and help me figure out how to get that money into your real estate deals.
Somebody says that, you're jumping, right? I mean, you're ready to help.
Yeah, totally. So we did that, and he's now invested in 3 projects with me. Got about $1.5 million invested in various things that we're doing. But we've been able to assist a lot of clients in how to do self-directed IRAs and 401ks. And I have my favorite companies. I won't advertise them here, but if somebody wants to call, they're welcome to do that. But the interesting side of all this is the 1031 tax deferred exchange investor. They cannot invest in the LLC because it has to be a like kind exchange, real estate for real estate. You can't exchange a real estate project for an interest in an LLC. So we find that especially we can take the land and have LLCs acquire the land because it's real estate. And then they acquire the land and we form what's called a tenant in common agreement, a TIC. And that word has been used for good and bad. some of the ticks in past years have not been good with investors, but it's generally because the sponsor that's doing the tick has no vested interest in the project. In our situation, we put our own capital in, we sign on the notes, we guarantee the loan. So we really have a vested interest to see that the project is done. But we then can take those 1031 investors and marry that with the LLC, and those two become co-owners of the project, and the tenant in common agreement is what controls, as opposed to normally an LLC. And by doing that, we found that we've been able to get all those interests together in the same thing, in the same project, and have it be successful.
So just to reiterate there, like a 1031 investor can't invest in a regular syndication because they're buying a share of an entity. They're not actually buying real estate. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. They can't buy an interest in an LLC just because it's not considered a like-kind exchange. And the government requires for a 1031 exchange, it has to be like-kind, meaning real estate for real estate. It doesn't have to be an apartment for an apartment or an office building for an office building. It can be any type of real estate for any other type of real estate. And so you can do a like-kind exchange, and the exchange has to be for equal or greater value than the asset that you're replacing.
So now, instead of doing the LLC, you're going to do a tenant in common, and that's a way around, or so somebody can 1031 in.
Yeah, that's the way you marry the two, is the tenant in common becomes the controlling entity, and the LLC and the 1031 investors are co-owners of that. And so that's a way that you can incorporate all that money, all that investment capital into the same project and get it to work. A couple little nuances for 1031 investors that they have to be aware of when you're doing a deal like that. Those guys particularly have a different ownership interest in the asset that they're buying than they do in the project that you're building. For instance, you may buy a piece of land for $1 million or $2 million. And if somebody's putting in $200,000 in a $2 million project, they'll own 10% of the land. But maybe the project that you're building is a $20 million project. So their $200,000 investment generally isn't 10% ownership in the project. So you have to make sure that all the documentation that you do states that they have a certain percentage ownership in the land. And that translates into a different ownership interest when they're a part of a larger project. And so I couldn't stress enough how important it is to get good legal advice on how to do all of this. It's you don't want to go out and do this without getting good representation and making sure that you have people that understand not only the security side of the business, but the real estate side of the business.
And so you could be investing your $200,000 and only getting a portion of the land itself. And then this building's built, maybe it's sold later on down the road, but you only get a portion of the value of the land.
Yeah. So you may own 10% of the value of the land, but say you're building a $20 million project and you've got 25% of that you're raising as equity capital. So you've got basically a $5 million raise. So their $200,000 ownership interest represents $200,000 of a $5 million transaction. So they have a lot smaller ownership interest in the actual project. And we try to make sure that, so everybody is treated equally, that the tenant in common or the 1031 investors, their requirements mirror what we've done with the LLC in terms of the operating agreement. So everybody is getting treated equally. So I think that may be kind of a complicated kind of transaction, and some of your newer guys may not be ready to do a deal like that. But when you're talking about raising $5 to $10 million on a transaction to do a project anywhere from $20 to $40 million, somewhere in that range, it really makes it possible to incorporate all of those different types of entities and investors and raise a lot more equity capital than you could otherwise if you're dealing with just one investor type.
Nice. I appreciate that. And I'll take a little detour here. And, you know, Ken, just from your experience, you know, you've been in this business and highly educated yourself, which is amazing. But, you know, somebody that's just getting in now, you know, and they come to you and say, Ken, I want to get started in this syndication business. You know, what are some of the first key things that you know that they have to do to be successful?
Okay, so I guess start small. Obviously, you're not going to go out and tackle too big a project because your first investments are with family and friends, right? Those business acquaintances that you know. But I would probably start with maybe a triple net lease type project. You could do something like a Family Dollar, Dollar Tree, Dollar General. All of those are triple net lease. Or you can do some other type of small investment. Generally, I've seen some groups do these with fourplexes. We don't do many single family homes on this format because it just is so complicated and so expensive to do that it's unwarranted generally with a single family home. But with a small real estate deal of $1 million or $2 million, you could do this. And I would advise people to, you know, first of all, you got to make sure that the project that you're doing is not only suitable for the type of investment that you're seeking, but these things have a situation where they're small enough, but they perform well enough that you can give the type of return that you want to give to the investors. Because you're not going to attract any investment capital unless you can give a return that is suitable. And our typical return is, I know this may seem a little bit high, but on new development, you can do this. We try to hit a threshold of 20% IRR. A lot of times they're more within the 12 to 15% range. So our deals are a little bit more aggressive in that regard. But you've got to get in that 15% range. And then you've got to provide some sort of preferential return to these investors to attract them and be able to compete with the others. But if you can do that, you can be a small syndicator and get started and get going in these deals and do well.
Awesome. And what's a way that you have recently improved your business that we could all apply to ours?
I guess, you know, the social media side of the business is an area that I've really grappled with and we've worked on over the years. Just, you know, having a conversation with you is a way for me to get my message out to potential investors. But I found one of the best sources that has helped me is developing a good database of LinkedIn connections. And I don't know if others do this, but for instance, I went to the state securities division one day and I said, which is like going to the IRS and saying, would you look at my tax return and see if I filled out the forms correctly, right? And if I'm paying enough in taxes. But I went to the state securities division and I said, I understand for me to do these projects, I have to have a pre-existing business relationship with these people that I'm doing business with. How do I do that? And what qualifies as a pre-existing business relationship? And they started out by saying, well, family and friends qualify to do that. And I said, well, okay, what other documentation do I need? And they said, well, if you have business relationships. And I said, well, how do you verify that? Well, they said, you know, if you got a business card, if you talk to them, they've talked to you. So I thought, okay, I'll work on that angle. And then I said, about my LinkedIn connections. And I had at the time about 250 first tier connections, so it wasn't very big. And I said, would those guys qualify? And they said, yeah, if you've got a first tier connection with some individuals that says they've reached out to you, you've reached out to them, and you've established a relationship. I said, how about my second and third tier? And they said, well, because I said, I've got over 1,000 of those guys. He says, well, we don't think those guys qualify because you really haven't reached out to them. They're just people that you could reach out to. So I went back to my office and said, okay, if first tier connections qualify as pre-existing business relationships, I better get with it. So I capped out at 30,000. And now I'm trying to figure out how to grow beyond 30,000 because LinkedIn stops you at 30,000. And yeah, but they have been terrific avenue for me to raise equity capital and develop relationships. So I send out a monthly newsletter. I call the Overland Advisor to any of those contacts that I've got. And it's been a good format for me to grow my business. So I guess the social media side of the business is where you need to go if you're really going to reach out to investors, because you can find the good projects if you work hard enough. It's just the hardest side of that ledger is developing the relationships with the investors and getting yourself known so people feel comfortable working with you and trust putting their equity capital with you. Because it's a big responsibility to be responsible for that capital that, you know, often they've taken years and years to accumulate, and you don't want to destroy that relationship or lose their money. So
that's right. And just a couple more questions before we run out of time. But Ken, what's the number one thing that's contributed to your success?
That's a pretty wide open question.
Just what you would consider to be the top quality or top thing that's really done it for you.
The top thing is just doing the best I possibly can to make sure that I give these investors a fair deal. And that seems kind of basic, but not every deal is going to work out the way that you plan it to work out. And you've got to be able to have the intestinal fortitude that when a deal isn't working exactly like you expected, that you're willing to reach out to those investors, be honest with them, tell them what's going on, and tell them the solution that you have for the problem that exists. You know, we had a situation where we did a feasibility study, had a great company prepare the study, all sorts of positive responses. You know, we knew it was the right market to be in. We built in that market, and within a year, we had four competitors sitting right on top of us. Well, so the rent up is not going to go as fast with four competitors as it was going to go where you were the only guy in the market. So you have to reach out to those investors and say, okay, here's where we are today and here's our model. But long term, we know we're in the right market. It's growing the way we want it to grow. And as the project gets stabilized, we're going to hit all our numbers. You just have to be patient with us getting there. And so if they know that, then they're willing to work with you.
That's amazing, Kent. We could talk about this stuff all day long, I know. But unfortunately, we're out of time. But I'd like for you to tell the listeners how you like to give back.
I'm guessing that most of your listeners are familiar with Rotary International. I was one of the founding members of our local chapter. And over the years, that has been an amazing way to give back. Rotary, many people don't know this, but over 30 years ago, they decided that they would eradicate polio from the face of the earth. That was a big undertaking. And over those 30 years, they've teamed up with the Gates Foundation and other entities, and with all of us contributing donations to that cause, they've eliminated it in every country but three, which is pretty amazing. And then being part of a local group, you get to do all kinds of charitable things with activities that you do, scholarships that you provide. I'm a Paul Harris Fellow, which sounds like a big deal, but there's a million of us in Rotary that are that. And we've all donated money to become Paul Harris Fellows, and then that money all gets used to do all kinds of third world projects like build schools. Our local group has built schools and done water projects in third world countries. And so we've been able to do a lot with a little. And that's probably one of the bigger ways I've found that has been really gratifying to give back.
Nice. Thank you for sharing that, Ken. You've been a great guest, and I really appreciate your time and you sharing your expertise. But tell the listeners how they can learn more about you and get in touch with you.
So we're the Overland Group, and you can find us on our website, overlandgroupinc.com, or you're welcome to give me a call. Our phone number is 801-355-1111. That's 801-355-1111. Or you're welcome to reach out to me personally, K. Holman. That's H-O-L-M-A-N at overlandcorp.com.
We can't reach out on LinkedIn, though, can we?
Well, yeah, you actually can reach out to me if you contact me through LinkedIn, I can put you in our real estate investment group. So we're growing that, and we've got several hundred members in that. And yeah, so that's a LinkedIn group that you can join to be a part of what we do. It's called Commercial Real Estate Investment Group and Network. So,
and then about the Overland Advisor, do you sign up for that on your website?
Yeah, you could just contact us. I don't know that we have the Overland Advisor that you can sign up on our website, but contact me, send me an email. I'll make sure that you're added to our Overland Advisor newsletter group. And that's all about investing.
Wow. Well, Ken, you've been a great guest. I can't thank you enough for your time. I hope we'll have you back on the show in the future as well. And there's so many topics that we could talk about and cover. Thank you so much. And I appreciate the listeners being with us today and every day. I hope you all will come back tomorrow. Hope you're growing your business and learning a lot from the show and sharing it with your friends. Please go to LifeBridge Capital and connect with me. Happy to schedule a call and help you any way I can. And we will talk to each of you tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to the Real Estate Syndication Show, brought to you by LifeBridge Capital. LifeBridge Capital works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate, while also donating 50% of its profits to assist parents who are committing to adoption. LifeBridge Capital, making a difference, one investor and one child at a time. Connect online at www.lifebridgecapital.com for free material and videos to further your success.